Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to an associate professor of political science who has joined with other scholars to raise concerns over Bill C-23, the so-called Fair Elections Act. Is it fair? We'll find out. We wade into the big news story from Brock last week, the town hall meeting designed to outline plans to trim the university's deficit, as we talk to Brock's Vice President of Finance and Administration. And if a glass of wine is good for you, how about two? We hear from a researcher who says there are anti-cancer and other health benefits in that glass of wine you're having. Raising a glass with class, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Last month, four Brock University professors joined with more than 150 scholars from across the country to sign an open letter to the Prime Minister of Canada that appeared in the National Post, registering their concerns with Bill C-23. In case you have not been following the story, Bill C-23, the Fair Elections Act, proposes a number of changes to existing legislation, and the 150 or so scholars argue these are a threat to Canada's democratic traditions. Brock political science professors Stéphane Dollier and Yannick Dubois are two of the four Brock representatives in this initiative, and they are quite vocal in their opposition to the changes. Assistant Professor Yannick Dubois was a guest on Inquisitive Minds last fall, you might recall, so I asked her to come into the studio once again to discuss the group's concerns with Bill C-23. We began first by discussing the proposed changes in Bill C-23, and when they would, if passed, come into effect.
Well, Bill C-23 has a list of changes in it. I think we can categorize them in a couple of main groups. Some of them, the changes, affect the way that people can vote during elections. And another set of changes affects the way that the elections process is overseen and how they're managed. So one is very much procedural from the institutional perspective, and the other one perhaps just as how citizens and elect people participate in the electoral process.
So can we go through the list of what the changes are? For people, they're going to say, Bill C-23, some changes coming. Well, who cares? It doesn't matter to me. Doesn't apply to me. But some of these do apply to you.
There's a number of changes that affect voters in their everyday behavior when they go to the polls. So one of the most substantive ones is the proposed elimination of voter identification cards. These cards allow people who generally don't have a driver's license to get a proof of address along with another government-issued piece of identification in order to vote at the polls. And so the elimination of this particular voter identification card is one of the things that will affect the day-to-day activities of voters. They would no longer be able to use that voter identification card and instead would have to use some of the other approved identification processes that's laid out.
The voter identification card, it seems so basic, but as you say, not everyone has a driver's license. A lot of us take that for granted. We're carrying around our driver's license on a day-to-day basis. But for a lot of people, voter identification card is very important to them when it comes to the day when they have to vote.
That's right. And the people who are most affected tend to be people who are already on the sort of margins of the electoral process. So we can think of students. At Brock University, students can get their voter identification card, another piece of ID. They might not be on the voter list because they have moved to campus, for example. And so students are one of the big segments of the population that use voter identification cards. And a lot of people in seniors' retirement facilities, they tend to use voter identification cards because they don't have an address necessarily of their own. They don't have a driver's license. And so really this proposed change targets some very specific groups that will be more likely to experience changes.
So if there's no voter identification card, what are these people supposed to do? If one of the pieces of ID you're supposed to use is your driver's license and they don't have one, what acceptable ID is there? Because I know that the health card, for example, is not necessarily appropriate ID in all cases.
Right. So there are a list of pieces of identification that are accepted according to the current rules, and that would be under the proposed changes. And so there are other ways that people can get on the voters list, and so that when they show up at the voting booth on the day of the elections, it wouldn't impact them as much. So there are ways around it. It's not like the elimination of the voter identification card means that people will not be able to vote, but it's just going to make it a lot more difficult for them to be able to access that.
And these are people who have enough difficulties to deal with anyway. It's just one more roadblock
that's
put
right.
up for them.
And I think that's really the difficulty with this bill, is that it creates a bigger distance between citizens and the electoral process. It creates these extra barriers that what we've been looking at in recent years is that people aren't participating as much in elections, and that we're seeing a decline in voter turnout, at least in a short and medium term trend. And when we think about reform, one of the things we might think about is, well, how can we improve the process? And the irony is that these changes actually distance electors rather than bring them closer into that process to make sure that we do have a more democratic system, that it's more legitimate, and that our governments are more accountable.
Yeah, we don't exactly have everyone voting right at the moment. It's unfortunately a sad case that the vast majority of people don't, maybe not so much in a federal election, but in some elections, just don't bother voting.
That's true. There are, of course, other ways that people are participating in democratic processes. We've seen, I think, the I Don't Know More movement, a lot of social mobilization that's happened in recent years. So I think that Canadians and citizens in general are not totally disengaged from the political process. But one of the roles that they can play is through elections to hold their governments to account. And when they try to exercise that right, and they're not able to because of some procedural changes that we've made and some fear-mongering over paper, I think that that's really what's difficult to accept as part of this legislation.
Now, the campaign donations issue is coming up, and you've got concerns about that as well, because they're going to be increased. So will this be a case of the haves against the have-nots as far as being able to run for office?
Well, in Canada, we've always had a very strong regulation around the role of money in elections. And some of our rules have been quite stringent. And some of the proposed changes in the bill would allow us to, for instance, increase the amount of money that people can donate to campaigns. And as a goal, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The thing that we should be more worried about is that how that change is being proposed. So, for example, it allows people who have already previously donated more than $20 to have an advantage relative to those who haven't. So what it does is it creates a sort of a dual standard where you have some people who are already part of the system who have been able to get larger donations to get even more. So we could see that that way that the money could start to play into elections would not apply to everyone equally. It would favor the parties that already have bigger donors at the moment would probably favor the Conservatives, and that would put the other parties at a disadvantage. So it doesn't really help to bring anybody on an equal footing.
I wonder how many people might be surprised to find out that you can fund your own campaign.
This is right.
So if you're a little more well-to-do than another candidate, this could favor you.
But there are spending limits on campaigns, and so you can't just throw all the money that you have and hope to get elected.
Exactly.
That still wouldn't pass our current rules. What this would do is allow more people to donate to campaigns and also allow them to put more money in our coffers. One thing that we've already accepted as one of the changes is that we used to have a per vote fund, so the parties would get funding per vote. And the way that that's made us have to rethink the way that we finance parties is part of a conversation that we really do need to have. But whatever solution we come to has to be one that actually is fair and accepted by all of the parties so that it becomes the new legitimate rule that everybody's going to play by.
So the poll supervisors issue, poll supervisors now appointed by Elections Canada under the proposals, those supervisors will come from lists of names provided by the candidate or party that came first in the last election.
Right. So if we look across the country right now, most of our polls were won by Conservative, which is why we have the government that we have now. And the change would make it so that most of the people who would be appointed as the director of the polls or supervisors of the polls in the next election would be appointed by Conservatives. And I think intuitively everybody kind of sees that doesn't fit well with us. It just seems wrong in some ways. Right now, the way it works is that these people are appointed by the Elections Commission. And so they're not appointed by a party. The Elections Commission can use lists that are given to them by candidates, but it's not a partisan activity. And this proposed change would make it potentially a partisan activity.
A little more biased.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So to me, that's one of the most worrisome ones on the list of changes.
I think that there are all worrisome. For me, it's probably not my top. I think there's just a lot to choose from in the bill. And for me, the most difficult change to accept in the proposed legislation is everything that surrounds the role of the chief electoral officer. The role of elections overview is limited in these changes. What the bill does is it takes away the power of the Electoral Commission, which is a nonpartisan commission that's there to safeguard our democratic rights and freedoms and make sure that our electoral system works without bias or without error to the best that it can. And really, we've taken its ability to do that as part of this bill.
Has there been any reaction from the opposition parties? If this favors the party that's in power, in theory, it could benefit them should they gain power in the future. So is there any incentive for them to not go along with this?
Absolutely. I think all of the parties have voiced concerns with the bill and have suggested that some of the electoral reforms that we do need be put on the table as part of a conversation. We could put the test of democracy to a vote in the House of Commons and say that the other parties either support or don't support it. Under a majority government, that's not really going to be an effective mode of opposition. I think that the most important mode of opposition that we've had so far is that from citizens, of people who are asking questions and saying, why is it that these voter identification cards would have to be eliminated? Is that really what we need to fix the system? And are any of these proposed changes going to fix the problem that we already see, which is low voter turnout, less participation in elections, and a general disengagement from citizens from the electoral process?
Is there any public consultation process on this?
Well, I haven't been informed of any. I don't think that that's been part of the government's agenda. And I think that the opposition that we've seen generated in the last few weeks is a reaction to that, is saying, listen, we are making some big changes to our democratic system. Shouldn't we be having a conversation about how to do that, what changes to make, and what their impacts will have? And shouldn't everybody be at that table?
What kind of a time frame are we looking at? Should they go ahead with this, be able to go ahead with this to implement the changes of Bill C-23?
Well, that depends on the government's legislative agenda. So if they put the legislation to a vote, they would likely do that before an election is called. And as we've seen in the past, these changes can come about pretty quickly. They would be applied probably for the forthcoming election. And if this bill passes and it passes in its current form, we would have a very different electoral environment in a 2015 election than we did in the past.
This may be a little bit difficult to answer, but I'm just curious if other democratic countries have faced changes such as these in the past. Is there any knowledge of whether these changes being proposed are unique to Canada or other countries have sought out similar changes?
That's a really good question. One of the things that is very clear is that Canada has been a big player in helping different countries transition to democratic systems. And so we play a role, for example, in supervising elections and helping countries implement democratic elections in transitional states. And so we already have this reputation as having a democratic, a thorough election rule, a thorough electoral rules, and ways in which that we can export some of these best lessons or these experiences that we've had. So we've always been a player in helping other countries secure democratic elections. But at the same time, scholars have come out, and I think members of the public as well, to say, well, maybe we wouldn't be as well placed if we make these changes, because the changes that are being proposed don't fit with that same narrative of democratic processes, of having strong institutional rules, of having oversight. All of the rules but oversight are weakened under the bill, so our ability to do that internationally might change.
This open letter was published in the National Post in March. What kind of a reaction have you had to it?
There's been a lot of conversation, I think, not just about the letter, but in general about the proposed bill. Bill C-23 has been on the news. There have been some public demonstrations against it. And one of the catalysts has been also the activities happening in Parliament. So we have committee work in Parliament where committee is studying the bill to see what aspects of the bill we should keep and what we might be able to change. And as part of those committee meetings, they've had interventions by former electoral officers, officers by former BC Chief Commissioner in Mr. Neufeld, who had written a report about Canada's electoral system. And as more evidence is put on the table, I think that's been part of a new conversation about where is this going? And people are reacting to not only that information, but also the absence of that conversation happening beyond the institutions of government.
For other Canadians who are concerned about these changes, and I think a lot of them will be now that it's much more public now and we're talking about it through your open letter, especially so. Not everyone has the ability to get a whole bunch of people together and publish in a national newspaper an open letter to the Prime Minister. But what can they do to register their displeasure?
Every citizen has access to their members of Parliament. And even though scholars have written this open letter, people can write their own letters. They can write their letters to their MPs, they can write letters to the Prime Minister, and they can ask questions about the electoral reform proposals that are put on the table right now, and they can get engaged.
Simple as that. They don't even need a stamp.
That's right. You don't need to put a stamp on a letter that goes to your MP. That's your mode of communication.
Some may wonder about the power of that letter, but the power of many letters directed to the person about a cause can speak volumes.
That's right.
So there's strength in numbers.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Janique, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Brock University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Janique Dubois. One of two Brock professors to include their names in an open letter, actually four of them, to the Prime Minister, expressing their concerns over the implementation of the hotly contested Bill C-23, the Fair Elections Act. Last week, the grim news was delivered at a town hall meeting with staff and faculty members as steps were unveiled to cut this year's operating deficit at Brock from $14.5 million down to $7 million. The coming year, 2014-2015, won't be much better. In all, about 950 people, made up of faculty, staff, and students, filled the Sean O'Sullivan Theater, the David S. Howes Theater, or logged on to view the meeting via a webcast. President Jack Lightstone joined other senior administrators at the university to discuss the situation. One of those senior administrators was Brian Hutchings, Vice President of Finance and Administration at Brock, and he joined me after the town hall meeting to discuss the deficit reduction plans being put in place. I asked Brian if any of this surprised him when he joined the Brock administration staff a couple of years ago.
During the interview process, it was a number of interviews, and obviously I did look at, I'm an accountant, and did look at the financial statements. I knew there was some challenges at Brock University, yes, but not as great as what I had first saw.
Now, the university has incurred an annual operating deficit averaging about $7 million for the past 6 years. What was the thinking over this period as it was accumulating?
I think the challenge over that 5 years, the $7 million, first of all, the first year was 16.1, which was in 2008, and then it went to 7.6 and 5.7 and 1.9 and 2.2. You know, the president at that time installed a rescission exercise, it was called in those days, trying to get people to reduce their expenditures. And if you look at Brock's budget, roughly $300 million budget, $200 million is salaries of that budget. The rest is a number of different things, but you know, utility charges, debt charges, those things you can't change. You got to turn the lights on. Really, it comes down to about $20 to $21 million, really, that's kind of discretionary. But those are your things, your pencils, your pens, your teaching supplies, your purchases. So the rescission exercise what the president had installed was finding $2 or $3 million a year, but that had thinned out. That was a 4-year exercise, and that had really thinned out, and some decisions they're being made in piecemeal fashion to find savings every year, but they weren't really being made in the proper form as the future longevity and sustainability of Brock University.
You can't reduce a deficit that size totally with reduction of pens purchased and paper clips and that sort of thing. It's got to go deeper than that.
Yes.
So how did things get so out of hand?
Well, I think Brock has seen a large increase in expenditures. The expenditures, unlike any other industry, have been going up 6 to 7%. Whether it be salaries, we've had average salaries of 5 to 7% increase in salaries, not just total cost of living. I'll talk about that, but also it's been also increase in people at Brock. So there's been 5 to 7% in that area, as well as many other expenditures have been going up. So you've seen an average increase of 6 or 7%. A lot of that was being covered off by increase in enrollments. But that is, you know, when I started, I just happened to start, Brian Bowles and myself, we happened to start at the exact wrong time. I mean, enrollment was slowly starting to leverage out, to starting to flatten out. So in 2008, 2009, enrollment was going up, and it's starting to slowly just flatten out. So when I started in November of 2012, there was no enrollment growth predicted. And so with 6 or 7, basically if you drew a line, 6 or 7% increase average, with all of a sudden, bang, there was no more students. This university, it was one of the major reasons why the university now is experiencing the deficit problem it has.
So there was a period of time there where the increased student enrollment would help to offset some of the deficit, but you're not getting that offset now.
That's exactly right. So that's what happened was in the double cohort back in the early 2000s, leading up, the increase in expenditures of 6 or 7% were offset by the enrollment. But now, as I said, it started to leverage out, flatten out in the late 2000s, and then and now in 2012, 2013, as well as 2013-14, we've seen no growth in enrollment. We were also dealing with a system that's also starting to see it's plateaued and is on the way down. We've seen, on average, minus 3.5% across Ontario for applications last year. So not just at Brock University, but across the system. So it's becoming very, very, very competitive to attract and retain students in the university sector in Ontario and across the country. We've seen it already happen in Eastern Canada, where they've lost a lot of students, their numbers are down. Now you're starting to see Quebec and Ontario now face that challenge.
Yeah, I was going to ask about other universities. This is not just something that Brock is dealing with. There's, 21 universities in Ontario, and they're all facing the same problem.
Yeah, most of them are. Have various different degrees and for various different reasons. Brock is not alone. I said that during the town hall. Brock is not alone. There's a number of other universities facing the exact same challenges. And again, for different reasons, mainly for the same reason, for enrollment, growth has ended. But basically, the financing model is not kept up with the current university sector. There's been a big change in policy from the government point of view, from the provincial government point of view. There's been no inflationary increases to the grants. So how just let me step back for 1 second. So there's three sources of income, primarily source of income, or let's say four sources of income for universities. Number one is tuition. And everybody knows about tuition, and all students and parents know about tuition. In addition to that, there's grant funding. So the province funds us in a very complicated manner, but it's just for ease. It's pretty much, let's say it matches tuition. That has gone down. And then the third area is ancillary revenues, things like the campus store, parking, those sorts of things, residences, those sorts of things. And the last, but certainly not the least, is research. And then we also have some small amounts for endowments from donors and what have you. So those are four or five areas that we receive money in. I want to focus on the fact that there's been a big change in the government's thinking around funding. Really, the grant revenue has been frozen since 1991. There's been no inflationary increase. There's been increases. So, Michael, there has been increases, but it's been increases because it's matched the increase in volume of students. But those grants, those amounts of grants, have not gone up. They've gone up because of volume, but not over. There's been no inflationary increase attached to those grants, to the point where tuition and grants, it used to be in the old days, 33% of our revenues were tuition, and I think it was 45 or 50% of our monies were grants. It's almost inverted. We're now relying on tuition. The grants have become secondary tuition. The grants used to be the most predominant. So there's been a big policy change. There's been, no inflationary increases in grants. And also we've seen the government, which is a good thing, come out with some new programs, things like the Ontario Tuition Grant. It's been a great program for families making less than $160,000 a year. One-third of their tuition will be, they can apply and get one-third of their tuition back. Great program. You've seen MTCU, Ministry of Training, College, Universities budget go up because they're paying for that. They're paying that out to parents and families. Great idea, but not a penny is going to universities. So MTCU announced their budget's gone up, but that's gone up to pay the Ontario Tuition Grant. There's no money to go out and pay for facilities at universities or any increase in. So when it comes down to it, Mike, is when you look at the grants, you look at the tuition, that's about, works out to about 70% of our income When you can only increase tuition by 3% and the government funding's flat and there's no new enrollment, that adds up to be point. It's a whole bunch of math behind it, because when you look at weighted to the amount of income we have coming in and look at it, 70% of our income, works out to be 0.6. That 3% tuition increase of students works out to be totally at Brock University, 0.6% total revenues coming in. So that's less than inflationary rates. You know, let's pretend inflation is 1 or 2%. So we have to, you know, increase others. The other 39% of our area of revenues, things like campus store and research and stuff, have to disproportionately go up, because we have to fund the whole university, labor rates, inflationary rates, everything on 0.6%. And so it's just, to re-summarize, it's not a sustainable model anymore. With the tuition freezes, the investment in going to people, which is great, and not going to universities, and only trying to fund your university on 0.6% increase every year is not sustainable anymore. So the university needs to start looking at itself, looking at its expenditures, and trying to find efficiencies and to be sustainable. I want to make sure, I'm a Niagara guy, I was raised here. I want to make sure Brock University is around for another 50 years.
Absolutely, but less than 1%, that's minuscule.
No, I know.
It's a
challenge for all. It's a challenge for all. I mean, we're working on, again, just equate that to numbers. Mike, I'm a numbers guy, and I'll go back to numbers. But equate that to numbers. It works out to be about, just the tuition alone works out to be about $3 million. You know, every year for tuition. That's basically what we have to live off of. And on $300 million budget, $3 million on $300 million, that's where I'm getting the 1%, if I'm trying to simplify it down. That's all we have to work on every year for increase in revenues, besides, you know, things like residences and campus store. But we can only tap that well so much, and we have to make sure that our residents are competitive, and we're not making sure that the students receive a it's an honest rent for what they're receiving at the residences. So we there's basically, we're operating 1% per year, and we have to find other areas we can find efficiency in.
Yeah, you can't price those facilities out of the marketplace. It's not going to work. What's with the shortfalls of the pension fund?
The pension fund, at the town hall, I talked about $5.8 million. There's an ongoing increased contribution. In fact, that was from 12-13 to 13-14. There's actually, this year, it's going to be $6.1 million. That's another $300,000 more. The increase is due to probably a trifecta of three things. Number one, the 2008 markets, which everybody is aware of. I'm not going to get into that, which really hurt our pension plan. Number two is the actuaries will tell you that our wages at Brock are going up faster than what the average wages are in the local economy and in other areas. So obviously pensions are calculated based on what people's earnings are their last 5 years or what have you. So they've been going up faster, and we've had to obviously put more money aside to match this increase in salaries. And last but not least is the mortality rates. People are living longer, and that's affected the amount we're putting away. At Brock, we right now it's usually a matching contribution, but at Brock it's not. It's almost 3-1. It's Brock puts in almost $18 million to $6 million the staff do. So it's we have our own pension plan. It's a Brock University pension plan. Every university has their own pension plan. It's not grouped with others and what have you. So everything's based on what our rates of return on and what we contribute. So that's been the biggest challenge as well. That's a huge increase to us. This year it's $6.1 million.
Now, is that endemic again to other universities, or is that something that's just a Brock problem?
No, that's actually endemic to other universities. That's a good question. And I think I'm going to qualify everything I talk about. Most of the other universities, all these things, Brock is in the same boat as most of the other universities. In fact, on the pension side of things, Mike, Brock is called a going concern pension. That's a good thing. It's the province is qualified as a going concern. There's two or three other universities in the province that are in that same boat. Others are not sustainable at all. They have a solvency issue. So they're in a position where their contributions they need to make are so far overreaching they can't even make those contributions. Brock now has to put, because we're going concern, it's almost, we're in that kind of, where we've got a problem, but we can manage our problems. We have to put that money aside on our financial statements and set that aside. Some of the other universities are so in deep in their pensions, they can't even put that money aside. It's the money is so large. So we are in a very manageable situation. And our deficit, what you're seeing and what I'm talking about, is truly on our financial statements. Some of the other universities' pension amounts are so large, they can't even put them on their financial statements because they're considered a solvency issue.
I was reading about some of the expenses you've got to deal with, and one of the big hits has to do with the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex, a fabulous complex. But we're looking at $4.8 million for utility bills, operating costs, and debt repayment. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you're in a bit of a catch-22 on something like that, because without a facility like that, you can't attract A, the students, and B, the researchers to do the work that you're doing there. So you need that facility, but it is not cheap.
No, it's not. You know, it's also the snapshot in time, you know, when we're trying to show to people why this increase. I mean, we went from an average of $7 million, which we talked earlier, and all of a sudden we go to $14 million deficit projection, which we presented to the board last June, and they said, bring it down to seven. Like, you know, that's a... And some of the people challenged me and said, you know, it's because of Brian Hutchings comes from municipal environment, he's using different accounting techniques and things like that. We're using all, again, generally accepted accounting principles that KPMG certifies, all the other universities using it. So we wanted to show people the point in time, what was the change from last year to this year? And of that, one was the pension we just talked about. The second one was Cairns. Next year, when I show slides change from year to year, the Cairns has now been sunk. It's now we're spending that $4.8 million. But so a lot of people at the town hall focused on that. I expect to be focused on some HR issues and financial issues. A lot of people focus on the buildings and ask very technical questions on buildings and R factors and walls and all kinds of different things with that building. The $4.8 million is a large amount of money. Jack will tell you and others at the university will tell you. In 1999, before Jack arrived, Brock University made a big, huge decision. They decided they wanted to be a comprehensive university. They just didn't want to be an undergrad university feeding undergrads to other students, other universities for master's programs or PhD programs. They wanted to be a complete university. And so to do that, when Jack arrived in 2006, he went down around and interviewed people. You know, we need to focus on research. We need to focus on grad students and what have you. Our Mackenzie Chown building is quite an old building. It's filled with labs and a bunch of other classrooms. We did not have the facilities. We had professors that were at Brock University renting facilities from McMaster and Hamilton to do their science projects. Mackenzie Chown was outdated. We're now 10% of our students are grad students. We have 45 master's programs and 9 PhD programs at Brock University now. So those students need space. They need space to congregate. So many of the things we cleared out of Mackenzie Chown became grad students in their areas of research, but they also then moved those facilities over to Cairns. And Cairns really is, it's basically a big laboratory with glass around it. Mm-hmm. It's the building is probably the, you know, it's one of the top 10 in Canada. Building's got a CL3 lab in it. It's got an animal care lab in it. It's got all our I think it's over 70 hooded laboratories in there. It's quite the building. It's the machinery and everything else. It's a very expensive building. It's a $115 million building, which when you have that sort of labs in a building, you know, $4.8 million sounds like a lot of money. But those labs, those hooded areas, my technical staff, one of those hooded areas takes as much energy for one of the hooded laboratory areas as a 2,000 square foot house. Mm. And we told you we have over 70 of those in those hooded areas in that building. It's a very expensive building. I mean, I like to give the example of people, they have rat racks in that building that cost $72,000 for 20 rat racks, or one rat rack that has 20 containers for rats. So it just tells you the expense of that building. It's a very expensive building, but to attract the students we want to attract the professors we want to attract, and have the campus we want to have, a comprehensive university, that building had to be built. Now what we have to do is increase some of our research revenues from that building and hopefully cover some of those costs, those $4.8 million from our research revenues. And that's, you know, the challenge of the university community is try to come up with more research revenues to cover some of those new costs. But it's state-of-the-art building, and it'll put Brock on the map for years to come as well. One of the big reasons why I left across the road and left the region and came over to Brock in that building is our BioLink Center, which brings in businesses from across the Niagara region or who have new ideas and match it up with some professors. They work together with some of our MBA students and our business students, and they create ideas. And hopefully those ideas will become businesses that will settle in this Niagara region and help our local economy. Brock is a huge gem in this economy. I think we undervalue a lot how much Brock brings to this community. It brings 18,000 students, but as well as most communities realize, the Waterloos, the Hamiltons, the Torontos realize, the incubation capacity of universities is key to the future of their community.
I think with the problem with Cairns, people will look at it and it's so visible, you mm-hmm. can't avoid it. It becomes a bit of a lightning rod.
Yeah.
You look at that and it's, look at how much money was spent on this facility, mm-hmm. and now we're in the hole. And I think that's probably the way some people are viewing it.
I see. Yeah, I agree, too. And it's also one of those buildings. It was built with glass around it. So any light you have on that building shows. It makes it look like the whole building is illuminated, and it's not. And we turn those off. That building also has 5 greenhouses in it. We took the old alumni greenhouse out, and we put 5 greenhouses in it. So those greenhouses are lighted all night long. And even when we turned off the rest of the building during Earth Hour, we turned off the whole building besides the greenhouses, because obviously those experiments, the building still looks like it's lit up because it's, again, surrounded by glass. So it is. It does become a bit of a lightning rod, but I think in 20 years, I really do believe in 20 years, we're going to look back and laugh about this argument. It's a small investment to make Brock a future leader in what it needs to be.
Now let's take a look at what was discussed at the town hall as far as staff reductions are concerned. Where are they coming from, and how are you going about it?
So we announced at the town hall 86. We're reducing 86 positions at Brock University. The first step, which is the largest, it's about half of them, is through attrition. So positions that people retired from or resigned, and we looked at and said, do we need to replace these positions? The number one filter, Mike, we used throughout it all, through our senior management, senior administrative council, and our senior management talked about was, does this affect the academic mission? Does this affect students? And if we could say, no, it didn't, or yes, it did, then that was our demarcation point. So we made sure that we felt that didn't affect students and the student experience, as well as obviously the academic mission of the university. So basically, we took 86 positions and moved them to 46 over the last 6 months from people retiring and not renewing positions. We then had another 9 positions where we redeployed. A program would end, and we decided not to run that program anymore. I think like our continuing education program, where we offer, it's a continuing ed, it's more of a community program where we offer kind of walks through the Short Hills Park and things like that. So we didn't think that was integral to our academic mission at Brock. Many other community groups are doing things like that, so we said we'd step away from that. We had a staff member in that area, and she was moved over to Youth University, for instance. So we redeployed people throughout the university. 9 of those were redeployed. 10 were terminated. That's the hard. I was up front with that at the town hall. 10 were terminated. Where we said we try to redeploy people, try to find other positions for them. It wasn't positions that matched their skill set, and we terminate 10 positions. And we announced at the town hall that 27 more between now and April 30th will be working with the local unions, trying to find attrition for people or possible retirements. We're also looking at redeployments within the union, but between now and April 30th, some of those positions may be laid off.
Now, are we looking at some point as far as faculty is concerned, reductions?
At this point in time, no. As you know, the faculty most of those faculty members have tenure and what have you, and it's not in the current collective agreement we have with our faculty. We are, when I use the word redeployment, we obviously, when faculty retire, we don't have to put new faculty back to the same area. When we hire a new faculty, it could be another area of greater demand at the university. So that's the provost's job, and his senior team with all the deans, they work on those sorts of decisions, and they look at the various enrollments, capacity and the demands, and review that with each other and make sure that that's matched up again, so the students are connected with their faculty members, and also it doesn't affect the academic mission.
Okay, so what happens next year? This is for this year, mm-hmm. 2014-2015. Are we looking at more cuts, or is this going to be enough?
I'm hoping it's enough for this year. I think next year we know that's, again, there's about $3 to $4 million more in new revenues for next year when we look at tuition. But we know that we also have challenges next year. We know there's $1.6 million for more operating costs for the downtown facility. That'll be on next year, May 2015, which we're excited about, and a great thing for St. Catharines and the region, Niagara region, and Brock, and our students. But we also know that the province changed the way they fund education. Our faculty of education go to a two-year program versus one, so half the students. Also, they lessen their grant amounts for those students. That'll cost us $3.8 million. So those two things alone, the 3.8 plus the 1.6, brings us to $5.4 million. I just told you we're going to get $3 or $4 million in revenues. We're going to be looking at efficiencies throughout the year, number of efficiency targets, but we know we have a challenge going into next year. I know the $3.8 million is a one-year challenge. It'll probably reduce down to $2 million, but still, we know there's a challenge next year. So can I say there'll be no more reductions of positions? The answer is no. Am I trying not to reduce any positions? The answer is yes. So we're trying to focus on this year, and then hopefully we're trying to find a sustainable model for Brock University. My challenge, when I get to the board has set a goal to get the zero deficit this year. That's my focus from now until June. Over the course of the summer, our goal is to sit down and look at, work with the university community to try to find a sustainable model for this university without these staff reductions. It's not a healthy environment to keep going on. I get it. I understand that. And I don't want to see it either. I'm used to growing businesses, seeing them decline. And I want to build momentum, want to build people's spirits. So we're hoping redeveloping a vision as well as a model that can make us move us forward at Brock.
But you also know from your background that you couldn't go on this way forever. It had to end.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yep. Something had to change. Yes, you're right. And some things still need to change. I mean, we still need to look at various efficiencies at Brock University, how we do certain things around the university and what have you. But it couldn't continue. We would be insolvent. And I used that word at the town hall, which I think struck a lot of people. Our current financial situation, we cannot continue on the way we're doing, or else we'll be insolvent. So we're at a point now, very fine point, where we're almost borrowing to pay for our interest costs. So you can't continue to do that. We need to get our ship in order and put it on the right track, and then we need to be responsible on all our demands and increases and what have you. So if we can do that, and everybody's responsible and respectful of their current situation and the current environments out in the university environment, I think we'll be all right.
You've got a new website where people can go to find out more about how things are progressing. Where's the website again?
The website is brocku.ca/outlook. So it provides all the detail, and we always say in three different levels. So those that just want to skim it and get some general ideas, the next level, more detailed, and then for those really micro people who want to see details. And it deals with people. We call it people, budgets, and bargaining. So those three big areas, obviously we're going to have some, also probably a part 3A after the town hall, and we're also going to add some details about some of the buildings. But that really, again, took me back a few steps, the discussion on buildings. So I work with my facilities management people on Friday. We got together and we talked about the number of things we need to talk about the buildings, mm-hmm. and the Cairns building and the various other buildings, because it seemed to have a lot of discussion at the town hall. So to be some effort on that as well. But brocku.ca/outlook, and it has all the details. It has our budget book, which has full details, our forecasting tools, our financial statements. It has discussions on our bargaining and with the three locals this year, as well as details on buildings and as well as people and some of the issues. We are going to try to hook onto that. I mean, since the Wednesday's town hall, I've had 2 days of board meetings. I got some emails to answer today, but I've had a number of emails, probably 10 great emails from people, basically giving me some ideas mm-hmm. about what we can do around Brock. And what I'm discovering is we need to, no more more town halls probably will come this fall, but we need forums. We need to get some people together in some room and listen. I said, people, the work starts now. We need to start listening, because those people who are doing their day-to-day jobs have some really good ideas, and we need to pull those ideas together and listen to them and put them in action. So we'd like to start, I'm going to have to talk to some of these people, email me, I'd like to start putting some of their ideas on the web, maybe anonymously, and people can build off them. And
sure.
So I've got some 10 really good ideas sitting in my email that I need to answer those people today and get back to them. So we want to keep those information coming and explore them and let people know they're being listened to, because only way, there's 5,400 people work at Brock University, 1,500 full-time and then about 2,900 part-time. There's a lot of good ideas and a lot of good momentum. We really need to tap into some of those ideas and build on them. And it's not going to happen, as I said, the town hall from four people, that's three vice presidents and the president. It's going to have to happen as a community effort.
Yeah, Brian, it's a tough job. I don't envy you and your team, but I appreciate what you're doing, and I thank you very much for coming in to talk to us today about it.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate your time, and look forward to hopefully we'll sit here this time next year and talk about some exciting future stuff at Brock University versus the kind of the things we had to do to right the ship. So thanks.
That was Brian Hutchings, Brock's Vice President of Finance and Administration, talking about the town hall meeting held last week, outlining their deficit reduction plans. We hope to present opposing views to the plan on next week's program. The health benefits of wine, and red wine in particular, has been a topic of discussion for quite a while now, and new research suggests wine, and again red wine in particular, can have anti-cancer benefits as well. Researchers from Brock and McMaster Universities teamed up and discovered polyphenols found in wine are shown to have anti-cancer and other health benefits. Their study, Inhibition of Human Lung Cancer Cell Proliferation and Survival by Wine, was published earlier this year in the journal Cancer Cell International. One of the researchers from Brock as part of the study team was Department of Health Sciences Associate Professor Dr. Evangela Ciani, who joined us recently by phone to talk about the study results and what we can take away from them.
We used wine, red wine and white wine that was produced here at Brock University by Professor Gary Pickering, that is from the Covey Institute. And we found an inhibition of cancer cell proliferation. So this is the first study, a very limited number of studies that used wine. Previous studies, including some of our own, found that a chemical, which is a polyphenol that is found in wine, has similar properties. Now, in our studies, we did a control group with just resveratrol, so we assumed that maybe the wine effects were due to the resveratrol effects, but we didn't really find any significant inhibition with just resveratrol at this concentration that you would find in wine. So we think that probably are many other chemicals and most likely other polyphenols that account for this inhibition of the cancer cell proliferation that we saw.
I didn't realize you actually using wine that was, you say, produced at Brock University?
That's correct, yes.
Does the variety of the wine determine the amount of the polyphenols present, or is it simply the fact that it's red or white?
That's an excellent question, actually. Red wine, it's proven, and we did our measurements as well, that it has more polyphenols compared to white wine. However, what we found is that white wine, although it contains less polyphenols than red wine, it had a significant effect to inhibit cancer cell proliferation as well. So we think that whatever polyphenols are in the white wine, although they are in lower concentration, may be sufficient to have anti-cancer properties.
Would rosé wine come into play here at all, or did you even test that?
We didn't test any rosé wine, but I would assume based on our data that it would have some effect as well.
Hmm. Do the polyphenols reduce the proliferation of cancer cells by a significant amount? What kind of measurement are we looking at here?
We just used one polyphenol as control, resveratrol. Actually, we used two other ones. And first of all, many other studies that were performed using polyphenols in cells in vitro, they use high concentration, 50 micromolar. And we have a significant inhibition at these levels. But the problem is that with this concentration that they use in previous studies, you don't find the same concentration when you drink one or two glasses of wine in humans in the blood. So when we controlled and we tested a low concentration that could probably be found in the blood of humans that consume red wine, we don't find a significant effect.
So how much wine would you have to consume in order to reap the health benefits that we're seeing here?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We haven't really done those studies, and that's what we want to do next. We're not going to do studies right away in humans, but what the next step would be is to perform some animal studies and have an animal model of cancer and see if by giving mice, for example, one or two, the equivalent of one, two glasses of wine in humans per day, if we can see a significant inhibition in tumor growth. If that happened, then we can move to studies in humans.
So this is going to be an ongoing study. We're not at the end by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure, yeah. This is just the exciting first evidence that is performed in human cells, but in vitro. And sometimes the evidence that you get from cells in vitro may not be absolutely the same in animal studies or human studies. So we definitely need to do more work to see if this inhibition is indeed seen in humans.
How long do you think it will be before you actually are able to test these theories with humans drinking the wine themselves?
It depends on many factors, and funding is a major factor as well. So first, if we had the funding, and we need like 1-2 years to perform animal studies and then move to human studies.
But the early results are suggesting to us that we can reap some health benefits from drinking wine, especially red wine.
Yeah, that's true. And probably you may be aware that the consumption of red wine, moderate consumption of red wine in humans, is associated with cardiovascular benefits. And I don't know if you know the French paradox.
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. That was going to be about my next question, about the other health benefits that are already known. There are more health benefits than perhaps some people realize in drinking in moderation, and that's the key, in moderation, some wine.
Yeah, I agree. Moderation is the key. And both studies in cells and animals, as well as epidemiological studies in humans, have shown that moderate wine consumption can decrease the lipid and cholesterol levels and improve the cardiovascular health. And as you are aware, in France, they consume the same diet as in North America and the rest of the Europe, but they have the lowest cardiovascular problems and death due to, you know, cardiovascular disease. And this has been associated with the moderate wine consumption.
And we all know that in France, they do tend to drink their wine. They love their wine. So maybe there is something to that.
Yes, they consume food and they have a glass of wine with dinner.
So the research was done in a joint venture between Brock and McMaster Universities. So how were you able to share the work between the universities? Were the tests delegated out? How were you able to combine the two universities on doing the work?
Sometimes, you know, collaboration, my students did the work and then principal investigators share ideas, and that's how we end up having a collaborative work. All the studies were performed at Brock University, but input from McMaster and Dr. Tsakiridis, that is actually a researcher and a clinician at the Jurevsky Cancer Center, was involved.
I was going to ask who else was involved in the study. How many people at the top level, like yourself, were involved in conducting the study?
So I had the idea, and then in collaboration with Dr. Tsakiridis and Dr. Pickering from here, from the Cavi Institute at Brock, we performed the study together. And Dr. Pickering provided the wine. He actually produced the wine. and he did some measurements of the polyphenols, and all this data are included in the manuscript, actually.
So is the same team going to work on the further research on this, or that has yet to be determined?
Hopefully, yes. That's our initial plan, so we see. Hopefully we're going to get some funding to move along.
Well, promising results so far, and I guess what we can take from it is the fact that wine in moderation, and that's the key, in moderation, is certainly not going to harm your health, and in fact can certainly help it, which is good to know.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about some of your other research at Brock, because you're heavily involved in a lot of other projects as well, and I'm intrigued by the so-called cell signaling. Could you tell me more a little bit more about the research, what you're trying to determine with cell signaling?
Yeah, our research is basically at the cellular level, and we look at the cascades and pathways that are activated in the cell that can lead to proliferation or activation of certain cascades. So basically, one easy way I can explain is that you can take a healthy cell, a normal cell, and then if you put a stimulant that will increase proliferation and amplification, so increases these certain cascades and certain proteins, the activity of certain proteins inside the cell, you can drive carcinogenesis, right? So basically, we are trying to examine and study in detail all these proteins and all these events that take place inside the cell that can lead to certain processes.
Is it improper cell signaling that could lead to problems with your health?
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the root problem.
And all the deviation from normal is what results in disease scenario and death. So if we know, and all the design of therapies and design of medicines to counteract certain diseases is based on this information that we get from the cellular level. And, of course, this is the first. So we look at the cellular level, what is happening, and then we go on to do more studies in whole animals and whole organisms.
So how can better understanding of cell signaling help us in our everyday lives? What can we take from it?
That's an excellent question. For example, one other study that I'm involved at Brock is to find ways to counteract insulin resistance and find medicines and chemicals that can be used towards treating of type 2 diabetes. So we found that a chemical that is found, an extract from a certain herb, can have the same effect in muscle tissue as insulin. And all this is done here at Brock at the cellular level with cells that we used for this project, rat muscle cells. And the information from this kind of studies can apply to everyday life, later on become a medicine for the treatment of type 2 diabetes.
Anything else you're working on currently as far as your research is concerned?
Basically, my focus is, as you mentioned, on cell signaling, and specifically with models that are focused to understand insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes and cancer.
Excellent. Well, it's fascinating research that's being done, and these early results both on the cell signaling and on the wine, the health benefits of the wine, inhibiting the cancer cells. Very encouraging news, and these will be continuing at Brock. Just another example of how the work at Brock University is really on the forefront of helping us with our everyday lives. Dr. Gianni, we thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And there we heard from Dr. Evangela Gianni, an associate professor in the Department of Health Sciences at Brock, who was one of the researchers on a joint study conducted by Brock and McMaster Universities into the health benefits of that glass of wine. I'll drink to that. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.